Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
When you hear the sound of coming,
hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is August 23rd, and this is the final installment in my series with Skinner Lane and Merritt Sperling on resolving the current digital malaise. Whew, it's malaise-y out there. So this is a one-on-one with Merritt. We focus in on his areas of expertise, his current work on Holochain and Vaxios. Our discussion moves from the evolution of the internet itself and later technologies such as blockchain into an examination of what it means to be active online and on social media, like so many people are, versus being conscious online and on social media, and what kinds of technology could encourage more consciousness. If you want to hear more on these topics in the future, please let me know. And even though these recent conversations were prompted by current events, if you listen to today's show and you go, "Huh, I could really imagine this still being relevant and useful a year from now." And I'm not saying you talk like that, but if you think those thoughts, consider supporting the show and go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. It has certainly been helpful of late as I am currently working to build a new production space. I'm getting excited to unveil that in the very near future. I'm gathering materials. I'm looking at different themes. You know, every time I rebuild the studio, there's a new theme. So I'm currently trying to create something that belongs in Pittsburgh. But again, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.com/AV to see even more ways to support the show. There's lots of options. I'm confident one is right for you. As always, I look forward to your feedback about this show, about this entire series, and I will return next week with something brand new. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. Merritt, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be back.
So first, I just wanted to get your thoughts. We're recording this on August 8th, and it might not be released until, you know, 9 or 10 days from now. But we're in the middle of a pretty significant deplatforming from all of the current, like, information dissemination channels, Facebook, YouTube, not Twitter, I noticed, for Alex Jones. What else am I missing? Spotify, and a friend of mine, Nathan, whose opinions I really value, I saw him post on Facebook, Alex was also banned, or the Alex Jones InfoWars Empire was also banned from MailChimp, which is an email marketing service, and one other back-end service as well. And he described this, my friend Nathan described this as peak 1984. Now, peak 1984, that's pretty lofty. So this morning, I get up and I read, Alex has appealed to the President of the United States, Donald Trump himself, the executive branch of the federal government, to become involved in creating a kind of internet bill of rights. And I'm saying, okay, well, that's more peak 1984 than yesterday, right? When, you know, somebody who has had this reputation of fighting against that power structure is now, I mean, this is nothing new with Alex Jones and InfoWars, but is now actually appealing to the government, right? And the dangers of this. But I think we're also, you know, aware of the fact these types of platforms, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, it's not what we would call here in America a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment does not protect, you know, our right to speech on any of these platforms. As people who are maybe more supportive of bans of people like Milo or Alex have pointed out, but you know, the people who wrote the First Amendment certainly never could have envisioned, I don't think, any state or any entity as powerful when it comes to being an arbiter or controller or limiter of speech, communication, and information. I don't think they ever could have envisioned anything as potent as Facebook, YouTube, Google, Twitter. But these things now are beyond the capability of any government to, you know, promote or to censor speech.
Yes, that's very true. I think we're sort of seeing this publicly visible political drama, and the temptation is to jump on any of these specific dramas and sort of beat your particular political drum about it. The free speech people will talk about free speech. The people who talk about undue influence of leftists, they will talk about that. But very rarely do I see people actually take a look at the underlying technological operative paradigms, the sort of infrastructure, the way that is built up, and the particular advantages or disadvantages it gives to particular ways of operating and particular people and organizations and ways of organizing. And so I think that's actually where the focus of people who care about the danger to free speech, the sort of one-sided political conversation should focus. I actually read an article recently that I found extremely insightful about the idea that the web, even in its current form today, is still a weapon for DARPA, for the for the U.S. government, and that's actually where it came from the U.S. military. And because we have this domain name system that still is a centralized sort of dispensary of digital places,
right,
that people are pretty much required to register with in order to have a presence in this so-called cyberspace, and have to agree to the terms of this organization, ICANN, for doing so, which is primarily under U.S. Control. And if you then also look at the global server lists of these sort of registrars, they're all controlled ultimately by U.S. Organizations. Pretty much unrecognized fact that in its now like extreme extrapolation has led to these particular dramas occupying our attention.
So divide and conquer, that's nothing new, right? Very level one as far as like commentary on this. The state's power, Joseph Stalin comes to mind, to exacerbate conflicts between groups to increase state power. I'm not saying that there's that such a design to that with this current problem, but because of the political divisions, and this was one of the things that I was looking for as far as the response to the Alex Jones situation. I mean, you know, I listen to Ben Shapiro and a couple other right wingers, and then I go over and listen to people like the Young Turks, David Pakman, Sam Cedar, you know, just YouTube progressive personalities, just to get a more complete picture of how people are interpreting this ban. Nobody seemed particularly excited about it. Maybe, you know, one or two progressive personalities that I encountered. But the political divisions that currently exist, I think, are kind of blinding people to the realizations that you're encouraging, that it isn't so much left versus right or new right versus progressive or this current pop-up movement versus this other current pop-up movement, becoming more about the people versus a kind of technocracy, right?
So, yes. So there are, of course, in mainstream consciousness, the most popular ways of thinking about this, which are 1984, Brave New World, these kind of utopia slash dystopia fantasies, which do point to particular particular sort of operative paradigms that influence how technology moves through society. There are also the sort of more traditionalist analyses of these, Ernst Jünger, Julius Evola, people who are criticizing or looking at how technology in the current way of sort of the cybernetic paradigm serves to build a sort of network power where no one singular person is really in control, and where the requirements of the technology of the humans that exist in that network actually lead to a sort of reverse adaptation, where the people, instead of the people designing technology consciously to serve specific functions, and then also being aware of the particular other effects it might have, the technology sort of has this Eigenleben, this sort of self, how would you say that, the self life that then determines the playing field in which humans operate, and then we sort of adapt ourselves to the technology. Now, I personally don't think there is a sort of it's very useful to think of this in terms of good or bad analysis,
right?
Because that's usually determined by whatever your highest value is. But instead, to look at what the operative paradigm, and I keep using this word, and maybe I should explain. The idea is that an operative paradigm is looking at what are the actual material mechanisms, dynamics, ways of operation of a particular system or a particular paradigm that actually are existing in reality. And so if you look at the internet, you see the server infrastructure, you see the domain name system, you see the origin where it came from, which had certain requirements for the design. I don't know, do people actually know where the internet comes from and what the design requirement was?
Well, I mean, the analogy here is, you know, the power system that we've all been so heavily relying on for decades, right? Everybody understands that when they take something with a plug and they stick it in their wall, it is able to turn on. Everybody, I think, has some kind of understanding that outside of their house, there's transmission lines that are coming from somewhere. And maybe, you know, the really astute observer has noticed that every once in a while you encounter a transfer station where the power lines get bigger. And those power lines, if you follow them, eventually go to some kind of power generation station. While people take this entire thing for granted, at several points in the transmission system, and you think about the power of this entire system, there are several points along the way where it can be manipulated to affect thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands or millions of people with the flip of a human finger. And there are many of these points in this digital world, in this information world as well, that people are completely unaware of.
Right. And the particular design actually of the internet when it was sort of initially proposed for the military was the idea of being able to, in a military conflict, have a communication system that can withstand and overcome the dropping away of individual central nodes. Basically, they wanted to have a decentralized, funnily enough, way of communicating, where if one particular node that was relaying information was taken out, the whole system would still function. So it's a curious coming together of two in sort of the rebel or anti conversations mindset contradictory philosophies of the centralization of power, which is government, but then also this idea of decentralization as a way to secure power and to overcome attacks on that power. And so the internet sort of is designed with that in mind, to be able to overcome those attacks. And with the particular choices being made in the design at the beginning, we have a particular playing field that then leads to particular ways of operating in that field being more advantageous, less advantageous, more competitive, less competitive. And so what we see today is sort of the outgrowth of that. Now, maybe I should go into some specifics here as to what kind of things this makes more possible or less possible.
Sure.
So one thing, for example, is that the way that I think of this is that we had the server infrastructure, which was imagined or designed by Tim Berners-Lee at CERN, actually, as a way to share information. This is sort of the second step after the initial communications ability at all had been implemented by DARPA as networking of computers generally. And so Tim Berners-Lee outlined in a proposal how he wanted to network academic computers, so-called servers, together in order to be able to share information between them, access research data, communicate via email, and those kind of things. And so the idea back then was actually to have servers be sort of the personal private property of the people who are sharing information into the network, that other people are stepping onto their lawn, if you will, and then are sort of in their house. And so there are sort of, you determine the rules of engagement there. That was a beautiful idea. And I think that still is the idea also that lots of decentralists or sort of techies are looking for. So this decentralized distributed web, the crypto people are all about that. But because of the difficulty of running servers, purely from a technical perspective, but then also from a cost perspective, we ended up with a landscape where actually Facebook, YouTube, Google, etc., these are the big places that we go to engage with the cyberspace. We already talked about this in a previous show.
Well, just so I'm understanding what you're saying so far, there's a parallel here between the debate we saw last year between Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Cash as far as centralization. And if you increase the amount of information going over the network, the Bitcoin Core people are like increasing the block size with Bitcoin Cash. The Bitcoin Core argument was that it would encourage or force centralization because fewer people would have the computing capability to keep full nodes of the blockchain on personal computers, right? I mean, there's right. a strong parallel between these two ideas.
Right. You can definitely draw an analogy here. Of course, there's some differences in the particularities, but yeah, that's definitely the analogy in terms of if you make it hard for an individual to set up, manage, terminate, change the particular ways of interacting with a network, then somebody else who can do that centrally and who can offer it for cheap in a sense, or who can make it easy, they will tend to find those as customers rather than people actually going through the hard process of teaching themselves how to do that and then actually continuing to do that. And I don't think that's actually something that we can sort of hold against people. It's just, why would anybody want to do that? Like, if it's so hard, and why is that even a requirement? And for most people, the consequence of that don't actually matter in their lives until it's like far too late and sort of multiplied across millions of people over many, many years.
Right.
And so that's sort of the playing field that we find ourselves in today. And so the question of the decentralized web that was the idea at the beginning, how can we implement that today? That's sort of where the crypto space says they want to go, but and has sort of fired the first shot with the blockchain architecture, which was specifically actually not designed for communication, but for financial technology, for being able to send value over a network to somebody else. And now we're sort of at the place where, okay, blockchain has been stripped from the core financial application and applied to numerous contexts, which it was not specifically designed for back then. And we're seeing those people run into a lot of difficulties scaling that architecture, making it adaptable, making it secure enough, fast enough. And so that's sort of the context in which the project that Vaxios is building on comes in, namely Holochain.
Okay. So Vaxios is built on Holochain, which is called third generation distributed ledger technology. So I want to go through that piece by piece. What are the prior two generations and what makes this the third generation? Let's deal with that first and then we'll define distributed ledger.
Right. Well, the sort of the nomenclature of these distributed ledger technologies is not particularly organized. Some people call, like, already talk about 4.0 or whatever. Like, that's less the point. I think the point is more that this particular technology has started from a very different starting point than the blockchain design started from. Like the blockchain design was specifically designed so that you could have people trust in a network where the participants are not able to arbitrarily copy account balances. Basically, you basically want to solve the problem of double spend. How do you prevent people from spending a digital resource, which by nature is pretty much non-scarce, it's abundant, unless you figure out a way to make it scarce or to make it, basically what the answer they came up with was to have everybody sync up to one ledger, which is sort of controlled through expensive economic means of changing it. And then also like everybody has to sync up to it. And the person who is able to add to it is the one that solves a mathematical problem first. That's that, or the computer that does that. That's basically the way that blockchain works in a very simplified way. And then the other problem that they wanted to solve is the question of Byzantine fault tolerance, which is basically the idea of how do you prevent somebody from, how do you prevent a misalignment of incentives from basically taking this network down over time because it becomes economically feasible or power feasible in a sense to actually disrupt the network or to change data after the fact and those kind of things. So that's what's the design proposition. How do we make sure, how can we attack the global financial system in a way that can't be counterattacked against from the financial system or from any attacker that might want to take it down. That was the idea. And with Holochain, the idea was very different. The idea was, okay, we want to have a way of having basically crypto collaboration or crypto coordination. That's sort of the tagline that I'm using currently. Instead of cryptocurrency, crypto coordination. And the design proposition was, how can we have social complexity, in a sense, emerge from rules? Basically, how can we keep people who agree to a shared set of rules accountable to those rules? And then how can we make sure that those groups can scale to, like, from just a few people to large networks? So that's sort of the design proposition. And so they ended up looking to different sources for inspiration and to different patterns to be able to do that. And the sources they looked for were living systems or biology or nature, as in how does nature solve the problem of coordinating a massive number of, if you will, agents that don't have a central authority organizing them, but yet somehow are able to coordinate effectively. If you think, for example, about your body exists as a conglomeration of cells.
Systems, sure.
Yes, exactly. Into greater systems, to organs, into the body. And where there is no central CEO cell, where there is no ledger that everybody's thinking towards, but instead, every single agent at every single level is sort of fulfilling a particular function. And they are paying attention to their own state, as in, like, how am I doing right now? And then they also pay attention to the state of the other agents that matter to their particular function and who are around them. And so they're sort of constantly shifting, constantly adapting, constantly changing their particular function according to the signals they receive from the people around them. And that's actually the way that nature scales. And this is actually also a basis for if we want to sort of look at the longer term parable, if you will, of where this will go, a vision for how politics can change from this very sluggish, slow, and very behemoth process of representative democracy with 4 years of representation and sort of one vote every 4 years, and instead to one where it's local communities basically have mostly sovereignty over their decisions, and then they confederate with larger and larger political bodies or sort of federations that then sort of end up serving their particular constituent members and the other way around, and sort of constantly adapting to each other.
Right. Instead of a sort of singular moment, you know, it occurs maybe once a year in some cases, or every 2 years, or every 4 years, but a very occasional moment where feedback is accepted. And obviously, right, that's, you know, a very tightly managed and manipulated process as well. But it creates, I guess, for most people, what is a satisfying enough illusion, at least satisfying enough to prevent a revolution, that the system is open to some form of feedback.
Right.
But you're talking about a sort of constantly changing, like in nature, the adaptation is almost based on constant reception of input.
Right, and that's you touched on a good point there, which is sort of this receptivity, this constant paying attention to signals around you. And if you look at how we're actually currently organizing ourselves on levels smaller than nation states, you and I are currently talking through Skype. I, with my family, have a WhatsApp group that I coordinate with around. Like, it's that the feedback there is not taking place on, like, let's have a family meeting every 2 years and then figure out, like, how we're going to do things. You can still do that, but that's usually just a measure that you escalate towards when the smaller or the more quick feedback loops are not able to keep up with the complexity of the challenge that you're facing. And so, right, the idea should be to, and this actually is an idea that the European Union was based on, but that it has gone against, unfortunately, in many respects, which is this idea of subsidiarity, the subsidiarity principle, where decisions should be made at the smallest possible unit or level, and only if they are unable to solve it, be passed up in the ranks.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the design inspiration where Holochain comes from, and then the stuff that this makes possible goes far beyond what I sort of just outlined. Like, this is the governance stuff that we sort of briefly touched on, and there are multiplicities of possibilities of how to manage social groups, and that's actually one of the hopes for this and predictions for this technology becoming more and more used by developers and then by businesses and communities and activists. Actually, that's actually one of our strategic focuses at the moment, as I'm working with Holochain at the activist communities of whatever political inclination they may be, to have a Cambrian explosion of social forms, if you will, of social, mm-hmm, DNA, of how groups constitute themselves, manage themselves, and enter into arrangements with other groups. And that's really where, like, a large part of my interest in this comes from, less that we are suddenly able to, like, speculate more effectively on the rise of some token, but to actually steer ourselves better and require less the central point of failure, or, like, the central authority to make decisions for us, where we are actually much more able to do that by ourselves.
So where is adoption at right now for Holochain? Who's using it and for what?
Right. So the code itself is still in alpha, which means that we are currently talking with a lot of different folks at different organizations, for example, with the Mozilla Foundation, for Firefox, with a bunch of other people in the sort of decentralized web space, about how to make the standards such that developer adoption is easy. And because it's still an alpha, we have lots of developer interest, and we've been doing, I think, more than 30 or 40 hackathons all over the world, where the interest has been growing significantly with every hackathon. But because it's still an alpha, we are not recommending people to actually have production systems run on it. But we expect that to be ready by about spring next year, and the beta should be out by the end of this year. And the reception we've gotten so far, primarily from the sort of co-op community, if you will, sort of left anarchist style communities, mm-hmm, has been very good, particularly because we don't so much care about the financial speculation part, but more about sort of governance part. And that's what those folks care about a lot.
So financial speculation, you're talking about, like, the current applications of blockchain technology?
Right.
Okay.
Right. I mean, if you look at the space of blockchain usage, yes, there are some implementations that are actually solving a real problem and where actual businesses are choosing to use this for a particular purpose. Mm-hmm. But the large majority of the economic activity, if you want to call it that, in this space is the ICO market. And if you look at the ICOs, the sort of initial coin offering for those who are not into this, the 80% of those are outright scams. And then a small portion of the remaining percentage are actually on track to deliver something. And so this is sort of analogous to the dot-com bubble, if you will, that suddenly something new was possible. Like the internet gave rise to this incredible swell or surge of ideas that people were able to communicate well enough about that other people bought into it, but were not yet familiar enough with on how to deliver to actually create something that had economic viability.
Right. So a feeding frenzy took place. I mean, I certainly remember this happening. People at the time, because of the novelty of it, were unable to discern maybe what they should be feeding resources and what they shouldn't be feeding resources. So resources were being fed, but those resources could have been much better allocated if those systems or those markets were more mature.
Right. And actually, one of the reasons or one of the things that we are strategically focusing on in approaching the distribution of this technology is actually taking very great care not to see the pattern of financial speculation, but instead to focus our efforts and our conversations on communities themselves that are interested in solving some particular need in their community. So the people who've built this technology, they come from a background of currency design, funnily enough, mm-hmm. but currency in an understanding that's very different from the one that we currently see with a token design or tokenomics that's being talked about, where the idea is more that currency is a way to connect up unmet needs of a community with unused resources of a community. And so the idea is that if there is something that you have, but that's not being made use of effectively, and you have needs that are not being fulfilled, although there is unused resources, then why don't you figure out a way to sort of coordinate people such that they can share the stuff that they don't need and use the stuff that nobody else is needing at that moment.
So what is this? What is this stuff?
Right. I'll give you a concrete example. There's this beautiful story of Curitiba, which is a Brazilian city in the south of Brazil, which had this problem of trash not being taken care of in the favelas that it houses. And so the streets were too narrow, the trash removal service was not able to get through, and so they were faced with this problem because this is a public health hazard, of course, and it's not good for the city in general. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they created a plastic token. They put up waste collection baskets at the perimeters of those favelas, and then they handed out to whoever brought a bag of pre-sorted waste to those collection facilities one plastic token, which was worth one bus ride. Okay, so they connected up. They connected up the sort of free time that people in those favelas have, because their sort of general use of time is not very valuable, and they gave them a way to make their use of time more valuable than other things they could be doing. And so what happened was the kids in those favelas ended up collecting the waste, bringing it to those collection facilities, getting those tokens, and then their parents mostly used those tokens to use bus rides to get to other parts of the city. And through this simple measure, today the average income of that city has tripled in comparison to the region, because the parents then get better jobs, people are able to have longer trips possible, so they can solve particular needs that they have that they wouldn't be able to fill where they live. And so through this very simple measure of spending no more money, but simply connecting up the unused resource of bus rides that the city already does, but where the buses are not actually at capacity, you end up like making everybody better off with nobody worse off.
And what's an analog in the holochain world?
Right. So the idea with holochain is to use a crypto technology in a way to codify shared rules for a set of people, and then to keep accountable all the members of that community to that shared set of rules. And the way that it does that is basically to make those rules in code. Then we could, I'm not going to go into the technical details of this, but have that code basically be the starting point for every action of a member of the community within a system that has been designed for that community or for that software that they're using. And then for every single action that people take within that digitally to be validated against the shared set of rules that they agreed to at the outset. So that's a very broken down way of thinking about this. And then a particular application you could think about is, I don't know, you can think of, for example, the doing the very same system in Barcelona, for example, but using digital means. Instead of a plastic token, people use their mobile phones to do the same thing. And they actually also have a problem with waste collection. But you could think of other things that are a valuable use of time. There are other applications that have been done before, which holochain could also help. There's, for example, in the Netherlands, in one town, they older people were not able to receive elderly care that they required. And so what they did was they had a time currency. They introduced time currency where elderly people could take care of like children, basically babysit children. And then for every hour they did that, they received an equivalent hour of elderly care that they could then contract from professional services.
Right.
And so that's sort of like what this does is sort of it opens up the space of the possible of what you can do from money, which is a very sort of one-dimensional, unidimensional way of connecting up people who have something with people who need something.
Right.
And instead looking at it in a community context and seeing, okay, what are the particular ways that people are able to contribute, which are not always money-based, but are maybe other services that they can do and that just need a way to keep everybody accountable. And that's usually the hard part. Why we resort to the market is because there is it's very hard to keep people accountable to the game. And so the easy way out is sort of to have people compete over a scarce commodity, which is money, which is centrally controlled in the creation.
Okay, so Skinner was talking about software as a kind of voluntary private legal system, I think for the very same reasons that you're outlining here. Now, there might be people listening who are saying like, yeah, but isn't this kind of the same thing that you two started out the show complaining about with these large platforms? And I think the distinction here is the decentralization.
The distribution.
The distribution. Okay, so Facebook is asking you to do everything in your life that you're not already doing through Google, through Facebook, right? Connect with Facebook. So we have super, super centralization. You know, I was listening to Michael Malice's show, and he was talking to Anthony Cumia, who's somebody who gets banned from things and fired from places. You know, he was Opie and Anthony was a big, like, morning drive, sort of Howard Stern competitor here throughout the 90s. And he runs Compound Media that has employed people like Michael Malice and Gavin McGinnis in recent years. And, you know, he was even saying that, you know, the psychology of this is like if Twitter just shut off tomorrow, no one would care because it's gone. It's kind of like if the world ends, you know, is it a tragedy if nobody is there to observe the tragic nature of that event? He said if Twitter just disappeared, no one would care because no one's missing anything on Twitter. But if I get banned from Twitter, I'm missing all kinds of things on Twitter, right? So there's this emotional aspect to this where these platforms are such central parts of life and so many things revolve around them. You're talking about a system that allows people to piece by piece pick where they want to participate and where they don't.
Right. I think people can still have that that ability right now also to do the piece by piece, but the back end, the infrastructure that all of these different pieces that they use rely on are centralized. It's purely by the infrastructure, by the design of the of also of the ontologies. Like databases are central places, as we talked about previously, that are controlled by one particular entity and that dictates the terms, and that has by simply by the nature of the data being in a central place, has power over the people who generate that data for them in that central place. And so the actual design of Holochain is such that this system, instead of there being a central point where people show up to, like a place, like Facebook, you can think of Facebook like a place, right? Like even in our mind, we think of Facebook like a place that we go to, that we enter into, that we do things in, and that we then leave. And the same thing is true for these other places that we use, YouTube, Netflix, etc.
Yeah, but we also use, like, Facebook and Google, we also use it like, hey, I've been to this place or I'm from this place to go to other places. Yeah, sure.
Right, exactly, exactly. This sort of they sort of are marketplaces that other vendors go to and, like, get your data from their management.
Right.
Yes, to then sell you stuff on a bazaar, basically. Now, the shift in the dialectic or in the power dynamics here when you go to Holochain are such that in the Holochain system, people are sovereign over their identity and their data, which is stored or is generated and stored on their own device, which means that services like Facebook or their equivalents in a distributed fashion are asking for access to when they want to interact with you or when you want to interact with them, rather than them holding on to that and then sort of having that as a negotiating chip dictating the terms of use of whatever service they offer you.
So what would be the initial limitations on a user as far as, like, this is similar to the blockchain debate again, I think. What are the limitations on the user initially as far as, like, controlling their own data and having the actual technical power to do that?
Right. So this is where sort of our strategic choices currently matter, like where we're starting to have the conversations and where we're choosing to lay our focus with rolling this out, which is to not actually approach the end user first. Like, we don't have to play the propaganda war of winning the masses over to this new system, which I think is a fault in most of the crypto debates, and that I've also sort of complained about for a number of years now. I wrote a letter to the blockchain community about this thing. Like, don't try to convince people, make actual stuff that's valuable. But so our strategic focus of Holochain is to instead approach developers and business leaders or community leaders who then themselves choose to create services or platforms or protocols that serve whoever they are serving, like be it their customers or their particular internal needs or their community members. And so they then engage in a process of designing their particular system. And because Holochain is not like blockchain, one total connected system where, like, you have to store everything in one place, which is still the case with blockchain. Instead, you have people, again, storing stuff on their own devices and then using these protocols or services less like places that they go to, but rather like languages that they speak to each other. So you could, like, you can think of Facebook as a huge monolithic combination of many, many, many different services or interaction protocols, like the like protocol, comment, share. Right. There's a calendar thing, there's events, there's games, there's video, there's live streaming, there's a lot of different services in one place. All of those can still exist in distributed fashion. And then you can choose to opt into what you use. There might still be sort of these monolithic places that make it easy for people to do all those things at once or in nice combinations, but they will also be easy to do sort of separately or in particular combinations that make sense for the user. So the shift is from a singular UI that Facebook designs for you according to their incentives, what they want to encourage you to do, to you choosing to connect up different services that provide a specific value to you in a way that makes sense for your particular objectives. Like actually, I recently updated my my iPhone from iOS 11 to iOS 12, and I saw this feature of that's called Screen Time. Now, this is still designed centrally by Facebook by Apple, but the idea behind it I found pretty interesting, because the idea is actually we help you strategically place your attention where you want it to, and sort of help you keep yourself accountable to your own objectives in doing so, rather than encouraging you by the design of our software to spend more and more and more time on our device.
Right. So what the reality is on a lot of these current platforms is that individual user attention is very valuable.
Right.
Maybe not on an individual level, but mass user attention is very valuable, and you go after it sort of individual by individual with algorithms. But what that's also communicating, like the user experience is communicating to the individual user, is that your attention is valueless. Right?
Right.
You have endless time and attention to distribute to everything we put in front of you, which is also, you know, a lot of the clickbaiting, the advertising, the monetization of users, users being the product. It sounds like none of that is a factor here.
Right. Well, I think like it's always, always, always important to go into a new paradigm with not with blinders.
Right. No, I totally agree. I mean, I was wondering if people anticipated when the discussion started in blockchain, the ledger size being a possible problem someday, right? Because that
right.
was a very, when it was first introduced to me through the, like the libertarian community in New Hampshire, it was presented not across the board, but by many people as very utopian and the obvious solution to the thing that would basically put the Federal Reserve and fiat money out of business.
Right.
That has not happened. That is probably unlikely to happen. So, yeah, I don't want to say, yeah, this is great, Moritz.
Right.
All these problems are going to be solved. But I think there, when you talk about the way that the ledger is distributed, right? So people...
Right.
It's not a centralized location, and you don't have to have a, I mean, gosh, that's even kind of a tragedy of the commons problem there as well, where, you know, the debates that we saw over the block size last year spoke to that a little bit. But I mean, what problems, like maybe we could say that the centralized ledger problem was not anticipated in time.
I think it is like a intermediary step. Like we had to have sort of the blockchain thing happen in a sense to open up our eyes to possibilities that we previously thought weren't possible. I want to give blockchain its due. Like what blockchain did was it made possible to do these currencies. They may not be like forever scalable and whatever, but I think what for example, the killer application of Ethereum was to have these ICOs happen, which is an incredible thing, because it means that all those crazies who have these crazy ideas, even though a lot of them are full of shit and are like have the wrong idea or are trying to scam people, the few ones who don't, who would otherwise be unable to raise money through the VC, the regular venture capital or banking system, they are able to do it anyways because they can directly go to the people who have funds who believe in that idea. So I think that's really a really powerful thing. And so now that we have this capacity, the focus should shift, I think, to how can we do more things than raise money? And the more things, I think, are pretty much how can we enable people to associate with each other in ways that serve their particular interests and needs. And I think also allow them to remove themselves from interactions with people that are not necessarily in their interest, but then also, again, confederate with them when it is. Like, I think a lot of this debate that we see over, for example, also the Alex Jones ban now from all of these places is an unwillingness on the level of the populace in general to accept this idea again of voluntary separation, of self-segregating into groups that have different interests and that use their own infrastructure and that are not sharing sort of public utilities with people that they absolutely despise. And by then having been able to self-segregate, they are not anymore in this constant place of anguish where, because they are around people they don't like, they have to amplify their supposed ideological adherence to a particular ideology that they share with other people, at least on the surface, and sort of be very vicious about, and instead retreat, sort of go into their own places. And then when they do exit their places, they are able to engage with other people in a sort of more, I'd say, peaceful manner.
Well, if it's towards constructive ends, that's great. I mean, the cynic in me says, let's think about this. Every time somebody gets banned from Twitter or Facebook, shuts down a bunch of pages, I don't know about your newsfeed on either of those places, but mine appears with a bunch of posts like, okay, what are the alternatives to Facebook? What are the alternatives to Twitter?
Right.
Where are we all going to go next? Well, you know, so you have a platform like Gab, right, where a bunch of people who are more new right are going to talk to each other. But there's a major downside here, right? If that platform just becomes a kind of echo chamber. Like, I think that, you know, social media, the ideal is that different ideas come together in clash and, you know, to be super, super naive, in a kind of healthy and constructive way. So there's obviously going to be a cost, right, when it comes to the important conversations that need to be had and the bridges that need to be built in the achievement of understanding across divergent groups that we would like to see in many places, or, you know, maybe in some places. I certainly understand that that's not possible everywhere. But if the information landscape is allowed to have border walls with border patrols and increasingly higher and higher walls, that only seems like it's going to exacerbate the problem that we're already dealing with, because, you know, the internet is this series of, you know, echo chambers, and those echo chambers, people existing in that and, you know, having their biases confirmed, getting a kind of reinforcement or a kind of insularity in many of these places. Like, a lot of us can curate our feeds in YouTube and Facebook and Twitter in healthy ways, but people can also curate it in ways where they're never going to see anything that makes them feel upset or uncomfortable.
Right.
And then when they do manage somehow to encounter something like that, it's a major, major problem. So this current problem is something that I worry about maybe being made worse by what you're talking about.
Well, I think we have to remember that the idea of the filter bubble is sort of a very convenient weapon used against like giving people the means by which they can pursue their objectives, because it's not actually in the interest of power. Like, the interest of power is to have people be at each other's throats and sort of constantly waste their time on fighting against each other on these public forums, I think, and instead to and not to have them sort of self-organize, do the things that they need to do to serve their own needs, and then where it makes sense to confer with other people. Now, and also, we are not currently in a state where people don't already filter themselves into their own communities. I'm saying there's not actually a very big shift from people suddenly moving away from public engagement with people of different opinions into their own echo chambers. Like, that's already there. That's already here. It's just that the places where this happens are centralized, and the people who hold the power over how those places develop, they have certain incentives, and those incentives don't align with all or even a majority of the users of those places, or at least if you want to say this, like the higher or better selves of those people. So I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is also that filter bubbles have always existed, and they will always exist. Like, you can think of geography as a filter bubble. Like, basically, the filter bubble is just the idea that you receive inputs. Those inputs are necessarily limited in some way, by whatever criteria they are limited, and then you call that a filter bubble. The idea, of course, that we would like to push for people is to consciously choose to seek out information that goes against their particular biases or their current information diet, so as to not stay very one-sided idea, which then predisposes them to conflict with people who have other ideas. I think that's sort of, I'm not actually proposing that we're going into a utopia where people don't have to deal with people of other opinions, or where they're just self-segregating into their own communities and everybody's peaceful.
Right. So I think that, you know, right now, it seems like in the current information landscape, in the current social media platforms, there are very few incentives to, there's no financial incentives for the users to do what you're talking about, right? There are very compelling emotional incentives to do the other thing. We are more aware than we've ever been of the vast complexity of the world, but our need to make meaning of that world has not diminished in any way. So people are, I think, you know, one of the things that I see, and I can feel that impulse in myself sometimes, is to latch on to answers, right? Something that looks like a prepackaged explanation of an event or a phenomenon or an ongoing conflict in a very unconscious way, right? To satisfy in a superficial manner that deep emotional need to make meaning, to have understanding about something in my environment. So the emotional incentives to do that are very strong. And it sounds like this is possibly going to incentivize people to be more conscious users, right? Like right now, there's these perverse incentives about making people very active users, right? Staying on the platform right. a long time, engaging in meaningless and unconstructive activity on the platform, maybe based on some other kinds of needs that haven't been properly brought to the fore or audited or examined or whatever. That connecting to other tools through certain platforms like Google and Facebook. So there's no problem producing active users, but this, Vaxios specifically, seems to incentivize conscious users, right?
Right.
Because people have to, as we've talked about at a few points in this series so far, they have to put skin in the game. Right?
Right.
They have to put some kind of stake to share things, to kind of customize their own experience, to distribute content, to share content, to communicate with other people, to limit their exposure, you know, blocking advertising from their visibility. All of these things are options in this platform.
Yes, definitely. So what I sort of want to sort of in conclusion make visible here that goes into the direction of conscious media rather than sort of this commercially incentivized media that we're currently in is the idea that what this new technology allows people and communities to do is themselves determine what are the things that they value their attention for, that they want to spend their time on, encode that in some way, and then themselves manage and sort of hold each other accountable to those shared values. And so that's really what the holochain technology makes possible in a multiplicity of ways, be it in economic ways, be it in sort of just information sharing ways. And so Vaxios is sort of the project that Exosphere is pursuing to make that conversation transform or to travel from just an idea into actual implementations that serve the communities who themselves care about these issues that we've been talking about for these many episodes.
Right. And so it's an application, a real world example, or becoming a real world example of the ideals of Exosphere.
Right. Or perhaps a multiplicity of services that then people can choose to opt into on an individual basis. Like we're not going to build something that's a monolithic thing, I think, that people have to buy into the totality of in order to participate in, but rather choose to use the things that they themselves believe are valuable to them.
Excellent. Well, Moritz, I really appreciate you coming on and clarifying a lot of this stuff. I admittedly, this is a kind of a challenging conversation for me, but I really
Absolutely.
I value your expertise and your patience going through some of this stuff. I think you really brought a lot of it into focus for me.
And I think you challenged me to take the rather esoteric and highly abstract principles that I've been researching and make them more accessible. So thanks for that.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
You don't have to be, you can follow or lead the way.